The term helter-skelter has been commonly used in England for at least 400 years, meaning disorderly haste, confusion, undue hurry, lacking a visible order or organization, haphazard, a commotion. Neither helter nor skelter are actual words with any meaning themselves. The term helter-skelter was eventually applied to a carnival ride that consists of a slide which spirals around a tower shaped like a lighthouse. Climb up inside the tower and slide down around the outside. The first example of a helter-skelter could be found at the UK's Blackpool Pleasure Beach Amusement Park. It debuted in 1906. Clearly, this ride is the imagery evoked by the first three lines of the Paul McCartney-penned Beatles song Helter Skelter. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride, till I get to the bottom and I see you again. In the song, the ride seemingly becomes a metaphor for love or sex, even though Paul McCartney once claimed, "I was using the symbol of a helter-skelter as a ride from the top to the bottom, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, and this was the fall, the demise, the going down."
Manson's principal motive for ordering the 7th La Bianca murders was his fanatical obsession with helter-skelter, a term he borrowed from the English musical recording group The Beatles. Manson was an avid follower of The Beatles and believed that they were prophets speaking to him through the lyrics of their songs.
Charles Manson, the father, his family, and their legacy of Helter Skelter. Now, Lorimar Productions brings to full life Helter Skelter, the number one bestseller, the true story of the Charles Manson murders.
The White Album was, we were all in the middle of the sort of psychedelic thing, or you know, just coming out of it or whatever, but it was weird.
Paul McCartney would later claim that the song Helter Skelter was inspired in two ways. First, he wanted to defy his reputation as a writer of mostly ballads. Secondly, he remembered reading an article in Melody Maker about The Who, wherein he read that The Who had just recorded their most raucous, heaviest, dirtiest song yet, and he took that as a challenge. Quote, "I was in Scotland and I read in Melody Maker that Pete Townsend had said, 'We've just made the raunchiest, loudest, most ridiculous rock and roll record you've ever heard.' I never actually found out what track it was that The Who had made, but that got me going, just hearing him talk about it. So I said to the guys, 'I think we should do a song like that, something really wild.'" Paul McCartney could have been referring to a Pete Townsend interview in Guitar Player magazine where he discussed the new Who single, I Can See for Miles. But there was also a Melody Maker review written by Chris Welch around that time which stated, quote, "Forget Happy Jack sitting in sand on the Isle of Man. This marathon epic of swearing cymbals and cursing guitars marks the return of The Who as a major freak-out force." On November 20th, 1968, 2 days before the release of the White Album, Paul McCartney gave Radio Luxembourg an exclusive interview in which he commented on several of the album's songs. Speaking of Helter Skelter, he said,
"That came about just because I'd read a review of a record where it said, and this group, it was about some group, I can't remember, saying, and this group really goes wild and they just, it's like echo on everything, they're screaming their heads off. And I just remember thinking, oh, it'd be great to do one, the pity they've done it, you know, must be great, really screaming record. And then I heard their record and it was quite strange and it was very sort of, very sophisticated. It wasn't rough and screaming and tape echo at all. So I thought, oh, well, we'll do one like that then. And I had this song called Helter Skelter, which is just a ridiculous song. So we did it like that because I like noise."
He described his intentions as just as fuzzy and as dirty and as loud and as filthy as you can get is where we want to go. I was happy to have Pete's quote to get me there. The first recorded evidence of the song Helter Skelter comes from June 11th, 1968. As engineer Jeff Emmerich remembers it, "Neither Ringo nor George was present on that particular evening, and John wanted to begin compiling sound effects for what would ultimately become Revolution 9. So as soon as he learned that another studio was available, he decided to head off, with Chris Thomas and Phil, accompanied, as usual, by Yoko. The other studio, EMI Studio 3, became available at 7 p.m., which is when John and Yoko would have exited. However, as Jeff Emmerich continues, at one point a cameraman appeared to do a little filming for an Apple promo, and that interrupted the flow a little bit, but Paul just carried on, with his new lady friend sitting cross-legged at his feet. This film footage still exists today. It shows Paul McCartney running through sections of Blackbird, as well as his newly written song, Helter Skelter. He's playing an acoustic guitar, his then-girlfriend Francie Schwartz seated before him. Since the footage also shows John and Yoko, this off-the-cuff acoustic rendition of Helter Skelter must have been performed before they left for Studio 3 around 7 o'clock. Tell me the answer. Maybe I'll love but you ain't no dancer. Look out, Helter Skelter. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It wasn't until over a month later, on July 18, 1968, that the Beatles officially brought the song Helter Skelter into the studio for full band recording purposes, although the recordings of the song done on this day were essentially rehearsals. After extensive work on John Lennon's song Cry Baby Cry earlier in the day, the group returned to EMI Studio 2 at 10:30 p.m. to work out Helter Skelter. The session did not end until 3:30 in the morning. The Beatles ran through three drawn-out takes of the song with Paul on vocals and lead guitar, George Harrison on rhythm guitar, John Lennon on bass, and Ringo Starr on drums. Take 1 lasted 10 minutes and 40 seconds, take 2 12 minutes and 35 seconds, and take 3 27 minutes and 11 seconds, the longest ever Beatles recording. All of the instruments were recorded onto one track of four-track tape, Paul's vocals were isolated on a second track, and the other two tracks were left empty for possible overdubs later. The first 5 minutes of take 2 were included on the Beatles Anthology 3. These early takes were a plodding, slower version of the song.
Take 2. Thank you.
Technical engineer Brian Gibson, in the book The Beatles Recording Sessions, gives some interesting details about the events of this day. They recorded the long versions of Helter Skelter with live tape echo. Echo would normally be added at remix stage, otherwise it can't be altered, but this time they wanted it live. One of the versions of Helter Skelter developed into a jam, which went into and then back out of a somewhat bizarre version of Blue Moon. It wasn't until a month and a half later, on September 9th, 1968, that the Beatles decided to bring the song back to EMI Studio 2 and give it another try. The session began at 7 p.m. with Chris Thomas officially in the production chair because George Martin was away on holiday. That night, the Beatles recorded 18 more takes of Helter Skelter, with an even more raucous sound than they had attempted back on July 18th, but shorter takes at 3 to 4 minutes. As for the sound generated on this day, Brian Gibson remembers it as, quote, out of control. They were completely out of their heads that night. But as usual, a blind eye was turned to what the Beatles did in the studio. Everyone knew what substances they were taking, but they were really a law unto themselves in the studio. As long as they didn't do anything too outrageous, things were tolerated. Chris Thomas recalls one of the events of this day that was tolerated. While Paul was doing his vocal, George Harrison was running around the studio with a flaming ashtray on his head. The instrumentation for the rhythm track recorded on this day appears to have been Paul on rhythm guitar, George on a distorted lead guitar, John Lennon on piano, and Ringo on blistering drums. At the end of the last take, you can hear Ringo say, "I've got blisters on my fingers." That wasn't a joke. His hands were actually bleeding at the end of the take. In the Beatles book anthology, Ringo remembers, quote, "Helter Skelter was a track we did in total madness and hysterics in the studio. Sometimes you just had to shake out the jams." When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. That last take with Ringo's quote about blisters at the end was deemed the best take by Paul McCartney, and Paul would overdub his lead vocals before the session was complete, finishing up at 2:30 in the morning. The Beatles reconvened the following day, September 10, 1968, in EMI Studio 2 around 7 p.m. again, to complete the overdubs on the song and bring it to its complete state. Interestingly, it was John Lennon, not Paul McCartney, that overdubbed bass guitar on the song. Paul would play some strategic lead guitar parts, John, Paul, and George would sing background vocals, and Mal Evans would mess around on the trumpet while John Lennon messed around with a saxophone. That 27-minute version of the song that the band had recorded on July 18th was not forgotten by Paul McCartney. In October, he would ask for the extended jam to be mixed onto a tape cassette for his private collection. A stereo mix was created for the song on October 12, 1968 by George Martin with engineers Ken Scott and John Smith, and different from the earlier mono mix, the background vocals were pushed more into the background, Paul McCartney's lead guitar in the instrumental break was brought higher into the mix, and the chatter and extraneous sounds during the break at the 3-minute mark were left in. Also, a decision was made to fade the song back in so that we could hear Ringo shout, "I've got blisters on my fingers." The Beatles, or the White Album, was recorded between May and October of 1968, right after the band had spent time in India with the Maharishi. Many of the songs for the White Album had been written during this time, but the visit had not necessarily ended well, and the band members were probably a bit jaded or disillusioned. During the making of this album, this would also be the first time that Yoko Ono would be present in the studio. There was bickering between bandmates, bickering with George Martin, and bickering with engineer Jeff Emmerich, who would quit and leave the project in July. The next month in August, Ringo Starr would quit the band, but he was cajoled into returning. In October, John and Yoko would be arrested for marijuana possession.
"I have a record for life. I have problems getting in countries because this guy busts me. I've never denied having been involved with drugs, but at that particular time, there was a question raised in the House of Parliament. Why do they need 40 cops to arrest John and Yoko? That thing was set up. The Daily Mail and the Daily Express were there before the cops came. He'd called the press. In fact, Don Short had told us they're coming to get you 3 weeks before. So believe me, I'd cleaned the house out because Jimi Hendrix had lived there before in this apartment, and I'm not stupid. I went through the whole damn house."
And it caused you a lot of heartache.
It caused me a lot of heartache, and it still does. Concerned. So I want to know, any legal minds listening, how do I get rid of a record? Because the statute of appeals ran out, because I don't have a legal mind. And I went to find out about it at one time because I wanted to get this thing off my record. And they told me, "Oh, you should have applied within the first 2 years." Well, nobody told me that. And the only reason I pleaded guilty, because I thought they'd send Yoko away because we weren't married. And I thought, what's the word? They'd throw her out of the country. So I copped a plea, and the cop said to me, "Well, we've got you now, so it's nothing personal, you know."
Paul McCartney described the sessions for the White Album as a turning point for the band, saying, quote, "There was a lot of friction during that album. We were just about to break up, and that was tense in itself." While John Lennon later said, quote, "The breakup of the Beatles can be heard on that album." Of the album's 30 tracks, only 16 have all four band members performing on them. The White Album was released soon after recording was completed in November of 1968, the very same month that John and Cynthia Lennon's divorce was finalized, and a week before Two Virgins, with John and Yoko naked on the album cover, would be released and lambasted by the media.
Now, here, I read something that you said that you were very shy people in the globe.
Yes, you are, sir.
And yet, these are...
Does that prove you're not shy?
Certainly not. You only the shyest people in the world would take pictures like
well,
this.
Well, the shy people, are they naked? Do they ever become naked or not? Do you think that people that are shy have to wrap themselves up?
I'm following with your description of yourselves as... If
would you
that
consider
is
yourself
a
shy?
Picture of two shy people,
okay,
I'd like to know what shyness
shy?
Is.
May I ask you, would you consider yourself shy?
Oh, I'm just normal, but I think that everybody owes it to the world to prove they have pubic hair. And you've done it. You've done it, and I tell you that I applaud you for it.
I mean, if you want to prove it, you can prove it. Though.
Why don't you prove it now?
I don't feel that there's any great interest in it. Clearly, you must have felt the world wanted to know what your private parts look like, and now the world knows.
The White Album came out on November 22nd, 1968 in the UK, 3 days later in the US. The working title for the album had been A Doll's House, but that had been changed when English progressive rock band Family released an album called Music in a Doll's House. Basically, from the day it came out, everyone referred to it as the White Album. George Martin has said that he was against the idea of a double album at the time, and that he suggested to the group that they reduce the number of songs and make it a single album featuring the stronger work, but the band was against this. Helter Skelter ended up buried on side 3. No one knew at the time, of course, that the song would go on to garner quite a bit of notoriety and, one might say, infamy. Critical reaction to the song was mixed. Alan W. Pollock said the song will scare and unsettle listeners, citing Helter Skelter's obsessive nature and undercurrent of violence, and noted Paul McCartney's savage vocal delivery. Time Magazine's reviewer wrote that the White Album showcased the best abilities and worst tendencies of the Beatles. Skillfully performed and sophisticated, but lacking a sense of taste or purpose. William Mann of the Times remarked on the band's over-reliance on pastiche and private jokes, claiming that Lennon and McCartney had ceased to progress as songwriters. Yet, he would later deem the release to be the most important musical event of the year, and acknowledge that, quote, "These 30 tracks contain plenty to be studied, enjoyed, and gradually appreciated more fully in the coming months." In his review for the New York Times, Nick Cohn considered the album boring beyond belief, and said that over half of its songs were profound mediocrities. In a 1971 column, Robert Christgau of the Village Voice described the album as both their most consistent and probably their worst. As for Helter Skelter, in a 1980 interview, John Lennon would say, "That's Paul completely. It has nothing to do with anything, and least of all to do with me."
garbage dump, oh garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump? Oh garbage dump, oh garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump?
In the summer of 1968, the same summer that much of the White Album was recorded, a short, scrawny, scraggly career criminal turned cult leader named Charles Manson moved his cult to a dilapidated former Western movie set called Spahn Ranch. He seems to have had about 30 followers at the time, mostly troubled young women, many of them runaways. Manson had somehow convinced them that he was Jesus Christ, or at least some kind of a Christ-like figure, a prophet, and if they threw in with him, they could ride out the coming apocalypse together. But as each of Manson's predictions and premonitions failed to come to fruition, and his plans consistently went awry, he continually needed to find new manipulative ways to maintain his hold on his followers, to reaffirm their delusional belief in his strange omnipotence. The unconventional music and lyrics featured on the Beatles' White Album would become one of his tools and a part of a new narrative that Charles Manson would use to wreak havoc for whatever reason.
London. Two top film folk got spliced and the press and public turned out in force. He's Polish-born director Roman Polanski. She's American actress Sharon Tate. And the huge public interest their wedding created shows that the magic of motion pictures is as strong today as ever. After the ceremony at Chelsea Registry Office, the mini-gowned bride and the mod-geared mate made for the Playboy Club and a star-studded reception. Money's lavished champagne on some of the top names in show business. John Mills and daughter Juliet. Behind the fuzz, Lawrence Harvey. James Fox and delicious friend. Joan Collins and Anthony Newley. Two-fisted Terry Downs and from sedate Peyton Place, Barbara Parkins. Michael Caine keeping company with very dishy Candice Bergen. But the newlyweds weren't overshadowed by their big-name guests. Cutting the cake was the big scene of the day, and Roman and Sharon had top billing. The bride will keep working. Hubby says he wants a hippie, not a housewife. That was the only serious note of the day. The Tony Newleys got the star set really shaking.
One of these men will be happy to cut your hair for $25. What is your name, please?
My name is Jay Sebring.
My name is Jay Sebring.
My name is Jay Sebring.
Only one of these men is the real Jay Sebring. The other two are imposters and will try to fool this panel. Tom Poston, Peggy Cass, Barry Nelson, and Kitty Carlisle on To Tell the Truth with your host, Bud Collier.
In the end, Abigail Folger was stabbed 28 times. Do you remember her screaming at you?
Yeah, I remember her saying, "I'm already dead."
We have a weird homicide.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski. Miss Tate, who starred in Valley of the Dolls, was 8 months pregnant and was found in a bikini-type nightgown with a rope around her neck attached to the body of a man.
Two bodies inside, two bodies outside.
Among the other victims were Hollywood hairstylist Jay Sebring and coffee heiress Abigail Folger. Authorities would allow no one in an unofficial capacity inside the posh $200,000 home in the hills overlooking Los Angeles. When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines cut. The bodies had been dead about 12 hours. They were discovered this morning by a maid who ran screaming to neighbors. One officer summed up the murders when he said, "In all my years, I have never seen anything like this before."
While the police admitted they had no suspects in the Bel Air massacre, there were two more murders 15 miles away in the Silver Lake section of Los Angeles. Market owner Leo LaBianca and his wife Rosemary were found by their children stabbed and mutilated. The word "war" was carved into LaBianca's chest, and "death to pigs" was smeared in the blood of one of the victims. The word "pig" had been scrawled in blood on the door of the Bel Air mansion, where actress Sharon Tate and four others were slain. But police said, despite the similarities, they do not believe the crimes are linked.
That is about what we have at this time in the preliminary investigation. This we don't know because the bodies will have to be made an examination by the coroner to determine the cause of death.
There's no evident cause of death in that?
Not that we can say at this time.
Is there anything scrawled on the front door of that house in blood?
I can't answer that question.
Where were the bodies found? All in one room?
No. Two of the bodies were found in the inside the house. One in the vehicle, and two on the front lawn.
Were there any hangings or anything about that?
Not that we can determine at this time.
Wasn't there a body covered by a hood with a rope around its neck?
These are things that I can't give you too much information on at this time until the scientific investigation personnel make their report.
Was there any evidence of drugs there anywhere?
Not that I saw any drugs at all.
Did any neighbors report any noise, Lieutenant?
I'm sorry.
Did any neighbors report any noise in the area, any shots or things of that nature?
The neighborhood is being canvassed at this time. We do not have a report back.
Was there a party or what was going on last night? Do you have an idea?
We have no idea. This is what we're trying to determine. At this point, you must realize that we only have tentative and very meager amount of information.
Friday night in Los Angeles, a movie actress and four of her friends were murdered. And the circumstances were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school. And a short time later, not far away, a middle-aged couple was found murdered in similar circumstances.
The latest murders were discovered during the night, the bodies of a man and his wife found in their home. Lino LaBianca, a supermarket owner, and his wife had both been stabbed to death, repeated stab wounds. On his body, the word "war" had been carved in the chest. And then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on a refrigerator door the words "death to pigs." Hoods had been placed over the heads of both victims. With daylight, police searched the premises. They found no evidence of robbery, no suggestion of motive. A baffling crime and bizarre. The bizarre circumstances of those two murders last night were strikingly similar to the five murders at a home in Bel Air a few miles away 2 days before. This was at the home of movie director Roman Polanski, and it was his wife, Sharon Tate, who was one of the victims. She too had been stabbed, repeated stab wounds. One of the victims had a hood placed over his head, and the word "pig" was written in blood on the door. Now, today, police were searching here, too. Mr. Polanski had returned to Los Angeles from London and was in seclusion with friends. And police today could but speculate whether these two crimes this weekend, so grotesquely similar, had been done by the same person, or perhaps news reports of the first crime had inspired somebody else to do the second. The only suspect police had, William Gerritsen, the young caretaker found at the Polanski home, said he had been sleeping during the murders there. And so this afternoon, after much questioning, police let him go. Jack Perkins, NBC News, Los Angeles.
There was talk today about drugs and a mad killer, but the Los Angeles police are no closer to a solution of the seven killings of last weekend than they were then. Sharon Tate's funeral and the funerals of three of the four people murdered with her were held in four different churches. The services for Miss Tate, a remarkably pretty actress who was about to become a mother, were held in West Los Angeles.
This was the first that anyone has seen of Miss Tate's husband, movie director Roman Polanski. He was in Europe at the time of the murder. He was accompanied into the West Los Angeles Catholic Church by the actress's mother. Many of Hollywood's elite turned out for the funeral, despite the fact that it was billed as a private family affair. It was only one of four funerals held today for the five victims who were murdered at the Polanski's Bel Air estate last Saturday. Services for Abigail Folger, the coffee heiress, were held in San Francisco. Those for hairstylist Jay Sebring and the 18-year-old youth, Stephen Parent, were conducted elsewhere in Los Angeles. The funeral for writer Wojtek Frykowski will be held in New York City this week. Police are still baffled by the crime. The only new development came yesterday when it was revealed that a small amount of narcotics was found in the foreign sports car of Sebring. The car was parked in the driveway of the Polanski home next to Miss Tate's. Miss Tate's funeral didn't draw a large crowd, mainly because the public was not informed where it would be held. The service itself was brief, only 20 minutes long without a mass. Polanski appeared near collapse when he left the church, again accompanied by the dead girl's mother. All of Los Angeles is still shocked at the lurid, bizarre killings. Police officials say they hope to be able to solve the crime quickly, but as yet there are no solid leads. Jim Bennett, NBC News, Los Angeles.
Roman Polanski, the film director and husband of Sharon Tate, called newsmen to a hotel in Hollywood today, and there he made a long, emotional statement, told a good deal of what had been on his mind since his pregnant wife and four others were killed at their home on August 8th. He answered no questions, only gave his statement, but it was a highly emotional one.
Both Wojtek Frykowski and Jay Sebring smoked pot sometimes. I saw them doing it. In my house were parties where people did smoke pot. And I must tell you, furthermore, that I was not at a Hollywood party where somebody didn't smoke a pot. Sharon not only didn't use drugs, she didn't touch alcohol, she didn't smoke cigarettes. The last film she made was not a very happy experience for her. But her greatest picture she was doing was her pregnancy. I never seen a woman more preoccupied with it. The house is open now. The police has released it. And you can see, you can go and see the orgy place. You will see a lot of blood all over the place. Cradles, baby clothes, and that's all. I'm sorry for being so long, but I had to tell you whatever was on my mind. And I tell you last thing, that people who show me the most heart, understanding, and who change a lot of my opinions about certain circles were what we call fuzz. The cops were really very, very good. Thank you, gentlemen.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
This is where they lived, among the stables, barns, and phony buildings of an old rundown movie location 20 miles from Los Angeles. They called themselves the family. They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Constantly taking dope and stealing cars, and they just sit around all day and sleep, and that's about it. And went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner, and went to the store once in a while, and that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
The family left the caves they'd been living in on the Spawn movie ranch in the early fall, after the Tate murders. Later, police raided the ranch and found stolen cars. The family set up another camp in the desert near Death Valley. Five members are now in jail on other charges in the desert town of Independence. The family's leader, Charles Manson, is jailed here. It is expected that he will be charged in the Tate murders. People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group.
Who's playing? That's what the whole thing is. That we was doing out there was playing.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. A very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains and just like a deer. And he'd just wander around.
Was anybody stealing anything out there?
What sort of steal? We don't want to bother nobody. You know, all we want to do is get away from the city.
Police apparently got their break in the Tate case when this girl, Susan Atkins, a member of Manson's family, was arrested in another Los Angeles murder and talked to a cellmate about the Tate killings.
According to the police, and they have, in fact, shown me some evidence which indicates that they have a reason to believe that she may have been involved in both those other episodes, at least to some extent. I can say this much, though. She has at no time ever actually herself physically killed any person.
Are you saying she may have been present, though?
The police evidence has revealed to me would indicate that she was.
Pretty girl. Pretty, pretty girl. Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be. I'm your kind. Oh, your kind, and I can't see. Walk on, walk on. I love you, pretty girl. My life is yours. Yeah, you can have my world. Never had a lesson I ever learned, but I know we all get our turn. I love you. Never learn not to love you. Submission is a gift. Go on, give it to your brother. Love and understanding is for one another. I'm your kind, I'm your kind, I'm your brother. I never had a lesson I ever learned, but I know we all get our turn. And I love you, never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you. Never learn not to love you.
Never learn not to love. And
oh, I love that song. My brother Dennis did that, yeah.
Yes.
Good to see you again. You'll have to forgive us. We're in an awful time bind, and if we start talking, we're not going to be able to hear any more music. And boy, that's what we want. Okay. How are things in California? Warm and wet. They say it's fashionable to say to a California, have you moved lately? And many of them have, without wanting to. No problem. May we hear, what are you going to do for us now, fellas? Never learned how to love. Is this the acapella thing? Not to love. The next one's the acapella then. Okay. Never learned not to love. The Beach Boys.
Say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, be with me. I'm your kind. I'm your kind, and I see. Come on, come on. You're the pretty girl. My life is yours, and you can have my world. I'm your kind, and I see.
never had a lesson I ever learned, and I know I could never learn not to love you. Come in now closer. Give it to your lover. Love and understanding is for one another. I'm your kind, and I see. Never had a lesson I ever learned, and I know I could never learn not to love you. Come in now closer. Come in
Helter Skelter, the book by Vincent Bugliosi, who was also the prosecutor in the case against Charles Manson and his followers for the Tate-LaBianca murders, is the best-selling true crime book in history, more than 7 million copies. But as it turns out, as Tom O'Neill explains in his new book Chaos, Bugliosi was basically a scumbag, and his theory about motive in the Manson family case was fantastical without much basis in reality. Charles Manson might have preached this nonsense to his followers, who were a baffling, ragtag bunch of runaways and drifters, this nonsense about a coming race war and about hidden messages in the Beatles' lyrics. But did Charles Manson actually believe any of it? Or was he just grasping at straws in order to maintain this hypnotic hold that he had on his followers? Clearly, Manson was charismatic and convincing. He controlled people. They did what he told them to do. But did Manson believe what he was saying in order to exert this control? Did any of them truly believe it? Or were they all just different versions of mentally ill or desperate and lost on too many drugs? It was a strange time. Strange people congregating in strange places for strange reasons. What were the reasons? What did any of it mean?
Approximately a month ago, Charles Manson and several of his group came back up.
By how many?
He came up with 8 people, and they were all sporting knives in and saying how bad it was getting in the city and that Helter Skelter, that's what he calls the Negro Revolt. He says the Negroes are going to revolt and kill all the white men except the ones that are hiding in the desert. And he said that it was getting worse and worse and that he wanted to hide in the desert. And I believe he's on parole, and he's out of his parole area when he's up there. And when he came back, he started his games of trying to get me to go back with him. And he said that he'd release me from no agreements, that I was still his, and that I should be able to do anything he said and not think about it, because that's what love does. Love doesn't fight, it gives up. And to give up would be to be God. Charlie, or Charles, says that giving up is to become God, and that everything is God, and that eating meat is like eating yourself, and any time there's an animal there, any meat that comes in is given to the animal, and if there's food enough only for the dog to eat, the dog gets the food, and the people are supposed to suck on each other and get their nourishment that way, because everything's an oral fixation, a complex or something. And he calls guns phallic symbols, big phallic symbols that guys get their rocks off by shooting. And he says that people who need guns are the ones that are going to die. And people that have guns are the ones that he's going to kill. And that when Helter Skelter comes down, that the cities are going to be mass hysteria and that the cops won't know what to do. The piggies, he calls them. And that the beast will fall and the black man will take over.
It was going to be a racially motivated revolution, and that the blacks were going to control and take over the power.
Charles Manson was a career criminal. He had spent most of his adult life in prison. And the last time he had been released from prison, he had asked if he could stay. But they sent him out into the world, wayward and dangerous. And it's at this point in the story where Tom O'Neill's new book Chaos starts reframing the narrative. You see, Charles Manson was on parole, and he violated his parole multiple times. He was arrested and released without charges more than once while he was on parole. More than once, Charles Manson should have been sent back to prison. By law, he'd violated his parole. Even after the Tate-LaBianca murders had been committed, police launched a massive raid on the Spahn Ranch where the Manson family were living, and arrested a bunch of them, including Manson, for operating a car theft ring. Then they released them, with no charges. Tom O'Neill thinks Charles Manson was experimented on. LSD, mind control. He thinks Charles Manson learned from being the subject of these experiments how to use the same techniques, LSD, mind control, on his followers.
LSD, I don't consider a drug. I don't consider powdery a drug. Those are more or less religiously significant awareness, mind expanding apparatuses that come from the intelligence of the universe.
Charles Manson basically was operating a sex cult. He recruited runaway girls and orchestrated orgies. He said whatever he had to say and did whatever he had to do to maintain the cult. The murders must have been a part of maintaining that control. Charles Manson was familiar with the Tate House because Terry Melcher lived there previously. Terry Melcher was a record producer. Charles Manson had fostered a relationship with Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys. Dennis Wilson had picked up some of Charlie's girls hitchhiking. Eventually, Charlie and the family started squatting at Dennis Wilson's mansion for a while. Charles Manson wanted to be a rock star, but he wasn't good enough. And he was crazy. And yet, Dennis Wilson and Terry Melcher, these people strung him along. They were entertained by him.
Now I'm all around you, round you. Hey now, up on your heart I can sing through you. And I play and I sing. And they say, hey man, you got soul in that music. And I said, yeah, I play a little bit, you know. I like music. And they said, man, you're really somebody. I said, oh, I am? Well, I just got out of jail. I don't know what somebody is. They like my music. They say, man, we want to get you over. I said, get me over for what? They said, we take you down here to Beverly Hills, and we want to get you in with, because you're a star. I said, I'm a what? They said, you're a star. So they took me to the Beach Boys.
Well, it is a quaint house with a great view of the San Gabriel Mountains, but this Los Feliz property was also the site of a notorious murder that happened almost 50 years ago, and now it's up for sale. It was the home of Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, who were murdered by Charles Manson and his followers in 1969.
It's listed for $1.9 million, but will there be any buyers?
Charles Manson and some of his followers, they had once squatted at the house next door to the LaBianca house. So the locations of these murders weren't random, even though the victims were random. There's reasons why they ended up at these two houses.
My world is a sad world. Often wonder if there's blame. Such a fool in a mad, mad world with no pictures in my frame. Everyone says, crazy fool, you're always gazing at the night. With my arms around the tree, loving life with all my might. Crazy as I may seem, not knowing what to do, living with one crazy dream in a frantic world of blue. Such a fool in a mad world, loving life with all my might. My world is a sad world, often wondered if there's blame. Such a fool in a mad, mad world, with no pictures in my frame. Loving you without a name.
The reality is, it was all temporary. Charlie was always going back to prison. He knew that. In his book Chaos, Tom O'Neill presents evidence that Charles Manson and the family were under surveillance, perhaps even by the CIA, perhaps even when the murders were committed. It is now known, fact, that American intelligence launched covert operations designed to disrupt and discredit the counterculture movement in the late 60s. The Manson family murders accomplished those goals. It was terrible PR for the hippies. Personally, I don't think Charles Manson believed his own bullshit. The Manson family murders were not inspired by Helter Skelter. There's a very convincing theory that they were simply trying to exonerate Charlie's friend, Bobby Beausoleil, by creating copycat crimes similar to the murder of Gary Hinman, a crime for which Beausoleil was imprisoned. If they could make it look like Gary Hinman's murderer was still out there, then maybe Beausoleil would be released. It was a stupid plan. But Manson and the family, yeah, they were idiots. Just before the Tate LaBianca murders happened, Bobby Beausoleil made a call from prison. The call was recorded, and Tom O'Neill talked to people who heard the tape. And on the tape, Beausoleil was heard to tell Manson to, quote, leave a sign. You see, at Gary Hinman's murder scene, the word piggy had been written on the wall in Hinman's blood, just like they wrote pig on the door in Sharon Tate's blood. Helter Skelter is a wacky song. It made for a great book title. But Helter Skelter wasn't the reason Charles Manson orchestrated these horrible, senseless murders. Whatever the reasons were, it wasn't the song.
Helter Skelter is what? Race war? How long has there been a race war? How long have we been in race war? English? How long have we been at war with races? Since we come out of caves and you didn't like Irishmen? Helter Skelter was their song. They wrote it. You know, I didn't have no particular meaning to me. The district attorney picked up on that and made it into his trip. You know, so he can put Rambo in the movies. You see what I'm saying? In other words, he's got a lot more going than Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter's just one little foot he's playing. Now, he comes back to me from Geneva, wants to be my sunshine. If I'll agree with him on his Helter Skelter theory. I didn't have any Helter Skelter in my mind. Your mind's going to be in the miles an hour, man. I said, ooh. You know, that's what I call confusion. That's Helter Skelter, you know. It just means confusion. That's an English word. It's, you know. And then when the Beatles come up with it, I mean, that was their song. They were playing to those teeny boppers. Son, I'm not a teeny bopper.
February 18, 1972, the California State Supreme Court voted to abolish the death penalty in the state of California. The death sentences of the convicted killers in the Manson family were automatically reduced to life imprisonment. Manson himself becomes eligible to apply for parole in 1978. Susan Atkins, murderer, eligible to apply for parole in 1978. Patricia Krenwinkel, murderer, eligible to apply for parole 1978. Leslie Van Houten, murderer, eligible to apply for parole 1978. Charles Tex Watson, murderer, eligible to apply for parole 1978. Bobby Beausoleil, murderer, eligible to apply for parole 1978. Meanwhile, other family members, some implicated in one or more of the 35 killings admitted by Charles Manson, are right now either at liberty or awaiting parole. With Charles Manson in jail, does an era of madness now come to an end? Or will the social compost heap from which he sprang produce other, perhaps more virulent strains of Mansonism? Are there many more? Perhaps hundreds or even thousands of young Mansons germinating in the same hotbed that gave birth to Charlie? And will they be more antisocial, more aberrant than the original?
Criminal masterminds are more intriguing than Charles Manson. In the summer of 1969, the cult leader convinced his followers to kill 9 people. And in the years since, countless movies, books, and memoirs have cashed in on the Manson fascination. But just when we believed every possible angle had been exhausted, every theory scrutinized, journalist Tom O'Neill has come along with a new book titled Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. It promises to shed new light on what we thought we knew about the case, mostly from the iconic book Helter Skelter by prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi. O'Neill's story starts back in 1999 when he came to L.A. on a simple magazine assignment about Manson. Well, those first interviews with the key players in the case spawned a 20-year investigation by O'Neill that ultimately turned into his book, Chaos. I'll let him explain.
As I began my investigation, I sensed that there was something a little different than had been reported, some secrets that people had been keeping, and that pushed me to try to access witnesses who testified at the trial. And there were a number because at the time they were frightened of going public. They just wanted to not have any connection to it. Mm-hmm. But when I began in 1999, it was 20 years later. And people were a little less guarded. And with a little persistence, I started getting interviews and hearing different versions. And then to corroborate that, I went to try to get documents. And that took a lot of work. I beat down a lot of doors, and some of that took a couple of years. And then once I started getting actual, you know, original files from the case, from the DA's office and from the LAPD and the sheriffs, I saw that some things that happened differently and been presented deceptively to the jury at the trial and to the public and the prosecutor Bugliosi's book.
Chaos seems to dispute a lot of the Manson canon from the book Helter Skelter. And you mentioned Vince Bugliosi, who prosecuted Manson, who wrote that book. First of all, tell us about your experience with Bugliosi in researching the book, because it didn't read like you two were friends.
We began pretty fine. And in fact, the first meeting we had, he was one of the first interviews I did in April of 99. Yeah. And it was fantastic because he was completely, you know, he was an encyclopedia, but all the information he was giving me was like it was just lifted from the pages of his book. He had done it so many times. Yeah. And as any journalist knows, you want to get something new and get something fresh. And we call it the Hail Mary pass, where you usually save it for the end of the interview and you say, if there's anything that you can tell me and we can go off the record that I can use, and I won't attribute to you if you choose not to, it would really help me a lot. And he thought for a few minutes and he said, turn it off, turn it off. So I turned off my recorder.
Oh boy.
And then he gave me some information. That information snowballed, ended up coming back to bite him later, because it's on the record in the end in the book, because of the fact that when our relationship changed, when I started catching him, and then he completely turned. We actually didn't speak again then for 6 years until... Oh, wow. And then I went and had my big kind of confrontational meeting with him at his house again for 5 or 6 hours. That was 2006. And at that point, he said, are you calling me a liar? And I said, I'm not using that word, Vince, but you can't explain this and what you presented at the trial. It doesn't make any sense. And yeah, things spiraled.
What's the single most misleading thing Bugliosi and Helter Skelter put out there? What would you say is the single most misleading thing?
You know, part of it was about his covering up Terry Melcher's true involvement with the Manson family. I mean, even this massive raid that happened a week after the murders where the sheriff's department went to the Spahn Ranch and arrested the entire Manson family, including Manson, on car theft. It had nothing to do with the murders, supposedly. Took them in for 3 days, had all this evidence of crime, and then released them. Bugliosi, in his book, wrote that they were released because of a misstated warrant. Well, I found the warrant. I talked to the sheriffs who drew up the warrant. It wasn't misstated. Bugliosi also didn't report that Manson, when he was taken into custody, had 3 or 4 stolen credit cards on him. They had every reason to take him in, and instead they let him go 3 days later with no charges. And then if people read the book, they're going to find out that that was a pattern that had been set into motion from the minute he got out of prison in 1967. It was like catch and release, and monitor.
Now, your book brings up some names in connection with these murders that people might not be familiar with. So tell us about Jolly West.
Oh, yeah. Jolly West was actually a pretty prominent pioneering researcher, neuroscientist. There had been a program called MKUltra, which was a brainwashing program by the CIA. And basically, their ultimate goal was to create programmed assassins who would kill without any remorse. He had actually been alleged to have been a part of this in the 70s when it came out, and he denied it ferociously. You know, he actually threatened lawsuits. I got access to Jolly West files at UCLA, and it was really looking for a needle in a haystack, and I found it. It's a misfiled document showing that he had been not only a part of the program, a principal creator of it was Sidney Gottlieb, and the two men corresponded, and West kept his letters between both of them, and I found those letters where they're outlining the whole program in 1952, what they're going to do. And it sounds like a blueprint for creating a group just like the Manson family.
And with Jolly West, what was his connection to Manson? Did you ever get a link between the two?
Well, that's one of the reasons it took 20 years. His name didn't come up until a year or two into my reporting. I was in San Francisco interviewing the people who had the first contacts with Manson when he was becoming Manson in 1967 in the Haight-Ashbury. And they were the clinicians at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic. And Jolly West was there too. I was trying to find a smoking gun to put Jolly West in the same room with Manson at the clinic. The two of them were there for the whole summer and about a month beyond in 1967. Everybody who worked at the clinic said, well, he had to see him every day because we all did. Manson was noticeable. He came in with these five or six women followers who didn't speak unless he told them they were allowed to speak. Wes would have definitely been interested in them. But I was trying to find a document, and I was never able to show that they had an interaction. All they could do was present, I hope, a pretty compelling circumstantial case that they would have met.
Well, let's get into Charles Manson for a second, because there are different theories about Manson's motivation. Some say, he believed in a race war that would be the apocalypse in a lot of ways. What do you think, Tom, his motive was?
Well, one thing that I think is really important and has been neglected and not looked at for years is Bugliosi said in an early interview in 71, I think it was, with Penthouse, he was asked if he thought that Manson really believed in the helter-skelter motive. And Bugliosi said, I don't think he did. He goes, I think he knew there was no hole in the desert. He didn't want to ignite a race war. I think the girls did. And what the journalists should have asked as a follow-up question was, well, if he didn't do it to ignite a race war, why was it done? If he ordered those killings, in fact, why did he order them? What was the motive then? And they never asked Bugliosi that.
Now, you took decades to investigate and write this book. Tell us a little bit more about your process and what really compelled you to devote so much time and energy, so much of your life really into writing this book. I mean, it took 20 years.
I know. And sometimes I ask myself if I had it all. Everyone asks themselves about that. But I mean, what would my life be like if I hadn't said yes to the assignment? I wake up in the middle of the night some nights. I still can't figure out whether it would. It's all been worth it. I'm glad in the end, because I'm glad to get this stuff out there. Right.
So ultimately, people read your book 50 years from now. What do you hope that they will be able to take away from this book?
I think, if this is correct, that Helter Skelter is the best-selling true crime book of all time. Yeah. That's what they say. I don't necessarily want to compete with it, but I want to say, if you read Helter Skelter and if people are reading it from 50 years, I just want them to know that they need to read another book, because this is an incorrect story. And I'm hoping readers question the narrative and then draw their own conclusions about what my... I'm also hoping other reporters, you know, pick up my threads and keep going with them. I'm exhausted by this story.
Tom O'Neill is the author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Our name is Sharon Tate. She's today's kind of girl, bursting with youth, beauty, vitality, and hope. The hope was born 2 years ago at the MGM Studios in Culver City, California, in the offices of producer Martin Rensaw. It began with a contract with Filmways and an intensive program of lessons, study, and training to become a movie star. 2 years later, at the MGM Studios in London, Sharon Tate is reporting for her first motion picture, Eye of the Devil, in which she will star with David Niven and Deborah Carr. Many young hopefuls have started here. Some have become great stars. But before Sharon ever sees a camera, there are long hours of preparation. Hours of each day are devoted to beauty, hairstyling that will frame and flatter the natural beauty of her features, and makeup that will enhance them and project them onto the motion picture screen. There are other long hours of rehearsal, of analyzing each scene, each movement, with director J. Lee Thompson.
Sharon was faced with doing a very big and important part. Could she do it? That was in all our minds. We even agreed that if, after the first 2 weeks, Sharon was not quite making it, that we would put her back in cold storage. We started work. Very soon, we all realized that here was a girl who was tremendously exciting. She had that thing that you can't really explain, star projection.
Co-producer John Kelly knows the value of publicity and gives close attention to it. And even before the shooting starts on Eye of the Devil, Sharon learns that being a movie star also means being written about, talked about, interviewed.
I discovered, regardless of how many months and years of acting classes that I have had, I found that I know absolutely nothing at all. So now I can begin.
all rising stylists say, I wish they would not think of me as a beautiful woman. I'd like to play Shakespeare. No, that rings quite hollow.
Well, I don't fool myself. I can't see myself doing Shakespeare or anything like that. I would love like comedy, but it takes so long. You know, comedy is one of the most difficult types of acting to do. It takes so long because you have to be so serious, and that's the funny thing about it. And I haven't had the experience at the moment, but I'm giving it.
The work continues. An exercise program has been designed for Sharon's voice, and with each lesson it becomes lower, stronger, better control. And at night, Sharon studies her script, learning her lines and searching for clues to character and motivation. Sharon can usually be found making the scene at one of London's newest, innest discotheques. Sharon's date and dancing partner is David Hemming, the British star who portrays her brother in Eye of the Devil. Big Ben. London Bridge. England is a kaleidoscope of historic sights, like the Tower of London, which now houses England's crown jewels. From historic England to historic France, and the location site for the filming of Eye of the Devil. A medieval castle is the setting for this modern drama of suspense, and for Sharon Tate's first appearance before the motion picture cameras.
We were on location in the south of France, in a place called Brive. The area was kind of mythical, kind of foggy and smoky, and it put me in a great mood for my part. And Lee, you know, he's a very mysterious type man, very, very curious eyes. But he knew exactly what he wanted out of this character and knew exactly how to get it out of me.
Sharon was asked to play this very difficult role of a rather witch-like person. It was asking a newcomer to do a lot. She takes direction beautifully. Very soon she began to realize that the camera was a friend.
An aspiring actress must learn to be at ease with the cameras and complex pieces of equipment that crowd the set, and more importantly, with her technicians and fellow actors.
Deborah Carr is my idea of an actress and a woman, you know, a person. And I learned so much from her. You know, just little things. You know, it'd take a long time to, plus a lot of her things in acting, you know, to watch. She's so smooth, professional. It's fantastic. Really fantastic.
A car is waiting to take Sharon to the day's location, this time a vineyard near the castle. A few pauses in the day's shooting schedule allow time for a quick cup of coffee or a brief session with the ever-present still photographers. It's hard work, but for 22-year-old Sharon Tate, it's fun.
The first day that David walked on the location, when I was younger, I thought, well, this is the man I'm going to marry. So when he came up, I told him, I said, well, you know, I had plans for marrying you for many years. Oh, gee, he's so suave and so elegant and so handsome and witty. And the funny thing about it is I did my first film with him.
Sharon is a great discovery. First of all, she's a fabulous looking bird. And she's got all the fun and spark and go. She's a marvelous girl. She's up on cloud nine, Sharon is. And I think she's a very, very good actress. And I think she's going to make a big hit in this picture.
But don't you think that kind of ultimatum should come from Philippe?
Well, has Philippe said nothing to you?
Did he say he would? Did he lie to you? Oh, but you must be used to that by now. Men always lie. Personally, I have no use for them. Catherine, what's the matter? Is the sun bothering you? Are you all right? Would you like to go in? You're getting very tired. Would you like to go in? Your eyes are heavy. You must go to sleep. Catherine. Careful, Catherine. You might fall. Take my hand.
Odile! Help me!
I am helping you, Catherine. I
was Sharon Tate as Odile in Eye of the Devil. And this is Sharon Tate as Sharon Tate, girl on the go-go, getting her big chance at stardom. Her first film could do it for her, with stars like David Niven and Deborah Carr, and star makers like producer Martin Rantzehoff, and this man, director J. Lee Thompson.
The moment that Sharon appeared on the screen in her first rushes, we knew that this wonderful personality was going to make out. I think this girl is going to be a big, big star.
It's happening fast for Sharon Tate. Her second film is The Vampire Killers, to be followed by Don't Make Waves, both for Filmways and MGM. But the all-important one is the first one, Eye of the Devil. And it could be the lucky one, because all eyes are on Sharon Tate.